It is Wednesday, October 25th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington. Coming up, President Donald Trump mocks two U.S. senators who have criticized his performance in the White House. China unveils its new leadership, and a new film examines poverty in Florida alongside the glitter of Disney World. It's all ahead. U.S. President Donald Trump Wednesday mocked two Republican senators who condemned his White House performance, saying the very simple reason they're retiring is that they had zero chance of being reelected. In Twitter comments, Trump said Senators Jeff Flake of Arizona and Bob Corker of Tennessee now act so hurt and wounded. Trump's rebuke of Flake and Corker came a day after both lawmakers offered a brutal commentary on the first 9 months of his presidency. Flake, in a speech on the Senate floor, announced he would not seek another six-year term in the November 2018 elections. He then slammed Trump's behavior as dangerous to our democracy and called on other Republicans to denounce the president's conduct. His speech came after Corker and Trump traded taunts for hours. Jeffrey Skelly is a political analyst at the University of Virginia's Center for Politics. He spoke to me about the controversy.
This degree of combativeness between a president and prominent senators in his own party is really unprecedented. At least we've never really seen anything like this. I mean, there have obviously been conflicts between a president and members of the U.S. Senate before. However, really the one example people keep sort of going back to is Franklin Roosevelt in 1938, sort of leading what was known as a purge of some conservative Democratic senators in the elections that year, which pretty much failed entirely. But, even then, I don't think that the kind of rhetoric you see and the conflict you see between President Trump and now two retiring members of the Republican caucus in the U.S. Senate, it's much beyond that.
The fact that both of these senators, Senator Flake and Senator Corker, are stepping down, that seems to give them a freedom to talk about their, I guess you could say, their real feelings in regard to Mr. Trump. But I believe that Mr. Flake said that there are other senators that have similar views to his, but they're afraid at the moment to speak out.
Sure. I mean, look, at the end of the day, Donald Trump currently has a roughly 80% approval rating among Republicans. So criticizing Trump is dangerous politically for any member of the GOP, Senate or House or otherwise, because of the potential danger of a primary challenge or nomination challenge, if the state uses a convention system or something. So those who intend on keeping their offices or, trying to keep their office may not want to publicly criticize the president because they're afraid that it will prompt, a primary challenge. And so for Corker and Flake, they no longer have to concern themselves with that because they have decided to not seek re-election. And so they no longer have fear that, saying something is going to cost them electorally because they don't have skin in the game in that way anymore.
Well, this comes not long after former presidents George W. Bush, a Republican, and Barack Obama, a Democrat, also seemed to criticize Mr. Trump, but they did not criticize him by name. And again, usually former presidents try to stay out of political fighting. But, again, this seems to sort of speak to all the controversy surrounding President Trump.
Sure. Look, I mean, much of what President Trump is doing and saying and how he's comporting himself is unprecedented. We haven't seen this before. And those who have come before him in the presidency are obviously critical of him for acting in that way. And members of his own party are critical, whether publicly or privately, of his behavior and how he comports himself. So, no, we haven't seen anything like this. And, I think, we're such a long way from the 2018 midterm election and an even longer way from the 2020 presidential election. And so there's plenty of time for, I guess, more of this to build, more of this kind of criticism, public criticism to build. But I do think it's important to understand the country is very divided and that, largely speaking, Republican voters are behind the president. And as long as that remains the case, you know, I think you're just going to see a lot of conflict, a lot of back and forth, a lot of just distrust and anger. And, you know, I don't really see a light at the end of the tunnel.
Yeah, well, but in a way, could it be that the, because some observers say that the Republican Party itself is kind of splitting into what they're known as, I guess, establishment Republicans, and Republicans that are followers of President Trump?
Well, currently President Trump has, you know, roughly an 80% approval rating among Republicans. So, you know, it's, if there is a split, it's pretty clear which side's going to have a lot more people. So, you know, these things can change, and obviously President Trump's approval rating could get better or could get worse among the general public and among those who identify as Republican. So, you know, it's difficult to say where things are going to go, but, you know, I would be cautious on talking about some kind of actual split, you know, an actual, I guess, institutional split in the Republican Party. The United States has a two-party system. There are many systemic reasons for why that remains, even with all the conflicts within, you know, both major parties.
Jeffrey Skelly, political analyst at the University of Virginia Center for Politics. Well, joining me here in the studio is social media editor Andrew Pelshevsky. So, Andrew, what's going on?
Well, Sarah, the world is remembering Antoine Domino, or as he was better known around the world, Fats Domino, legendary blues and rock musician dying on Tuesday at the age of 89. Called one of the first stars and one of the founding fathers of rock and roll, and known for hits like Blueberry Hill and Ain't That a Shame. One person on social media I saw said, called Ain't That a Shame the happiest sounding breakup song he's ever heard. So certainly music that has stood the test of time and is part of our culture, not just here in the U.S., but around the world. Many fans remembering him and the music that he shared, quotes, including this one where he said, "As far as I know, music makes people happy. I know it makes me happy." And it certainly made a lot of people happy with his music. And over five decades in music, certainly a lot of fans that he picked up along the way. Also known, in addition to his musical endeavors, as a son of the city of New Orleans, was actually rumored back in 2005 to have died after Hurricane Katrina hit and destroyed his home. Someone went to his home and spray-painted "R.I.P. Fats, you will be missed" on the facade. Thankfully, at that point, he was still alive. He recovered, rebuilt his home, and lived up until this week. But lots of fans remembering Fats Domino today. And lots of fans talking about actress Alyssa Milano. Of course, we talked about her Me Too campaign that she started a couple weeks ago on social media to encourage women to speak out and use hashtag Me Too if they face sexual assault or sexual harassment. Well, Alyssa Milano is tweeting this week that that one tweet has brought together 1.7 million voices from 85 countries. Standing by side by side, she says, together our movement will only grow. So, in addition to that tweet, people are putting out and pushing out their own Me Too messages from around the world to support that tweet. Languages I've seen include Spanish, Japanese, Arabic, Hebrew. Really, this has become a global movement. And there's even a Me Too emoji that's been created by Twitter. It's three raised hands of different skin tones surrounded by a pink circle. And if all of that social media attention to this was not enough, there's actually a museum in Sweden that's compiling these Me Too stories and Me Too social media posts for an exhibit about the power of the campaign. So lots of attention, not just in the social media realm, but in the real world with this museum doing this exhibit. And if we needed any evidence that this was a powerful campaign, other than those numbers that we talked about and all of the people participating, there are also multiple people sharing reports that calls to sexual assault and sexual harassment hotlines have increased in the past couple weeks, which suggests more women are speaking out against abuse, not just on social media, but in real life as well. So this campaign has certainly done a lot of good around the world.
All right. Well, thanks very much, Andrew. That's Andrew. He's our social media editor, Andrew Pelshevsky. Here are some of the top news stories that are trending. Hillary Clinton's presidential campaign paid for anti-Trump research on his links to Russia. U.S. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson is on a tour of the Middle East and South Asia. The Kenyan election will go ahead as scheduled, and the European Union announces a $124 million in aid for Sudan. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on the voanews.com website. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
Scientists say for the first half of Earth's history, there was no free or breathable oxygen in the atmosphere. While some oxygen was being produced by early organisms through photosynthesis, most of it was being absorbed by minerals such as olivine. Then about 2.3 billion years ago, Earth's atmosphere began its first substantial and permanent inflow of breathable oxygen with the so-called Great Oxidation Event. According to a new study, this event took place around the same time as changes were being made in the Earth's crust. Study suggests as the crust evolved, the olivine nearly disappeared. Without that mineral absorbing so much free oxygen, the gas was able to accumulate in our atmosphere, providing the kind of air we know and need today. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Sarah Williams. Coming up, legal proceedings continue involving Sergeant Bo Bergdahl. A day after having his name and political philosophy enshrined in the Chinese Communist Party Constitution, President Xi Jinping was given a second five-year term as party leader Wednesday through 2022 and unveiled the new seven-man decision-making Politburo Standing Committee. Only Mr. Xi and Premier Li Keqiang were holdovers, with five new members, all in their 60s, apparently a sign of no likely successor to the 64-year-old Mr. Xi, who said his return as General Secretary represents not just approval of my work, but also encouragement that will spur me on. He promised to review past experience and build on the good momentum toward modernizing China's system and capacity for governance, deepen reform, and open China to the wider world, resulting in great rejuvenation of the Chinese nation. Jean-Pierre Capstan is a professor and head of government and international relations at Hong Kong Baptist University. He tells International Edition's Victor Beatty the new leadership strengthens Xi Jinping's position at the head of the Communist Party.
Among the seven members of the Standing Committee of the Politburo, four are clearly, including himself, but another three members are very close to Xi Jinping, to the party general secretary. Zhao Leqi, the leader in charge of the anti-corruption campaign and discipline within the party. Li Zhenshu, the new head of the Chinese parliament. And Wang Huning, who is in charge of the party ideology and the central secretariat of the party. They are clearly close to Xi Jinping. There is another guy, actually, who also has made allegiance to Xi Jinping. His name is Han Zhang, the former secretary of Shanghai's municipality, and who is going to be the executive vice premier, just behind Li Keqiang, at the top of the State Council of the Chinese government. And then you have two representatives of the old Hu Jintao faction. The Hu Jintao was Xi Jinping's predecessor. You have Wang Yang, who is going to take care of the Consultative Conference, a rather formal position. He will be in charge of United Front work. He will be in charge of relations with Taiwan and Hong Kong and Macau. But he won't be as powerful as the other leaders.
What does this tell you about Xi Jinping's leadership?
It tells us that power is going to be even more concentrated in the hands of Xi Jinping himself and in the hands of his allies. Now, if we look at the Politburo, the 25-member Politburo, you've got a lot of supporters of Xi Jinping, including the new party secretary of Beijing, Shanghai, Tianjin, and Chongqing. These four big cities and municipalities are going to be very faithful to Xi Jinping. And some provinces, key provinces or regions like Xinjiang region, and the Guangdong province are going also to be very much controlled by Xi Jinping supporters. Now, for the rest of the country, it may be more complicated, and that's where we're going to test, actually, the limits of Xi Jinping's power, because you've got a number of provincial leaders who are still rather autonomous and not necessarily close to Xi Jinping himself.
No clear successor?
Not at this stage. There's been a lot of speculation about Chen Ming'er, the new party leader of Chongqing, the city of Chongqing. He has not been promoted to the standing committee, and I don't think that Xi Jinping wants to promote him until the next party congress, if any, because there are a lot of speculations about Xi Jinping's ambition to stay longer in power, more than 10 years, and to sort of cling to power after 2022.
Jean-Pierre Capistan said despite China's central role on the international stage, the new leadership faces a number of challenges and limitations, with its growing debt a threat to economic stability and North Korea. He said Pyongyang, an insoluble problem in the past, not only represents a headache for Washington, but for Beijing as well, and will be a key test of the new Chinese leadership. The defense for U.S. Army Sergeant Bo Bergdahl has asked the judge to review a motion to dismiss charges based on comments made by President Donald Trump. Bergdahl could face life in prison after pleading guilty to charges that he endangered comrades by walking off his post in Afghanistan in 2009. As a candidate for president, Trump called Bergdahl a traitor who deserved to be executed. The judge, Army Colonel Jeffrey Nance, heard arguments in Fort Bragg, North Carolina, on the last-minute motion, which said Trump's comments were unlawful command influence that prevent Bergdahl from getting a fair sentence. Last week, Bergdahl pleaded guilty at a court-martial hearing to charges of desertion and misbehavior before the enemy. The latter carries a maximum sentence of life in prison. VOA Pentagon correspondent Carla Babb is attending the continuing court proceedings in North Carolina.
Well, Sarah, the judge is still considering a motion about unlawful command influence. That was President Donald Trump's comment last week on the Bergdahl case. So we do not know how he is going to rule that way. He said he's just not prepared to issue a ruling at this time, and he would issue one at a later date. We also have heard testimony from a Navy SEAL, James Hatch. He was wounded in the leg searching for Bo Bergdahl in July 2009. His dog in the unit was also killed during that search. And we've also heard from Bo Bergdahl's platoon commander, Captain John Billings. He was talking about the hardships suffered by his platoon looking for Bergdahl, saying that they were going for days at end. One example he said is a lot of the men had dysentery. He, in fact, had dysentery in his pants that he had to wear for 19 days. So he was just going through on all the different hardships that had to occur because Bo Bergdahl walked away from his post. That's where we are now, and the court is probably going to go back in just a few minutes.
Is there any indication as to when the judge might make a decision?
Not at this time. We still have lots of testimony left to go. There are still going to be testimony from a wife whose husband was injured significantly. In fact, he's basically in the hospital full time because he was searching for Bergdahl. So we still have no indications at this time.
VOA Pentagon correspondent Carla Babb. This is VOA.
When news breaks, VOA Africa is there, bringing you news as it happens. Listen to Africa News Tonight, Monday through Friday at 1600 and 1800 UTC. And our five-minute newscasts come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of VOA's Encounter. Join me and two advocates from the world of politics, public policy, or academia, debating critical and controversial issues of our day, bringing depth, perspective, and insight to the world around us. That's Encounter, every Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.
This is International Edition. Millions of children the world over dream of visiting Disney World. But Sean Baker's heartbreaking film drama, The Florida Project, throws light on those living in dire poverty right under the shadow of Cinderella's castle in Orlando. The film underscores the social divide in America through the eyes and lives of children. VOA's Penelope Pulu spoke with the director and cast.
The man who lives in here gets arrested a lot. These are the rooms we're not supposed to go in. But let's go anyway.
The Florida Project follows precocious 6-year-old Mooney and her friends roaming around during the sweltering Florida summer months. They live in cheap motels like the Magic Castle, barely supervised by their single underemployed or unemployed mothers.
When your friend puts you in charge of her kid, that kid becomes your responsibility. You ain't taking responsibility.
Filmmaker Sean Baker reveals the darker underbelly of an America that barely subsists.
My co-screenwriter brought this topic to my attention, the fact that there are families with children living in budget motels outside of what we consider the happiest place on earth, you know, a place for children. And that juxtaposition obviously grabbed me.
Baker was inspired by The Little Rascals, the comic shorts about a gang of children getting into trouble in the 1920s and 1930s. The series was set against the Great Depression, depicting poverty through the life and resilience of children. Brooklyn Prince plays boisterous Mooney, her childlike pranks verging into serious offenses. The motel manager, Bobby, played by Willem Dafoe, is the only one who can barely supervise these unruly kids. Dafoe's character was inspired by a real low-budget motel manager in Florida.
Thank you very much.
You're not welcome!
Bria Vinette inhabits Mooney's infantile mother, Haley. She loves her daughter and tries to stay positive, but she's unable to get a job or any kind of child support and slowly crumbles. Vinette says she drew from real-life women who have fallen by the wayside.
You have a daughter who you have to take care of, a roof to put over her head, food, and then on top of that, you have to take care of yourself. And it's just like, I feel like in her situation, her concerns aren't even important to her. It's about Mooney.
Both Vinette and Prince, who'd never acted before, delivered tour de force performances. Eventually, Mooney's childlike optimism gets tested by the stark reality that an uncaring society will ultimately decide her fate. Penelope Pulu, VOA News, Washington.
And that is our show. Please visit our website at voanews.com. I'm Sarah Williams. Thanks so much for joining us.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Cambodian Prime Minister Hun Sen's government took legal steps to disband the Cambodian National Rescue Party, or CNRP. The U.S. is also deeply concerned by the National Assembly's passage of amendments to Cambodia's election law. If ratified, these amendments, in conjunction with the lawsuit by the Cambodian Ministry of Interior to dissolve the CNRP, would effectively disenfranchise the millions of people who voted for the CNRP in the 2013 and 2017 elections, said State Department spokesperson Heather Nauert. If the main opposition party is disbanded, Hun Sen's government plans to redistribute its 55 seats in the lower house of the National Assembly to five political parties that didn't win any seats in the 2013 general election. In a statement, CNRP lawmakers, all of whom boycotted the legislative session, called the approval by ruling Cambodian People's Party members of parliament an abuse of power and the will of the people. This is part of a trend by the Cambodian government to stamp out dissent from all sources, including the press. Recently, government authorities shuttered an English-language newspaper, the Cambodia Daily, for allegedly not paying a large tax bill. More than a dozen radio stations that broadcast dissident voices or used programming from the Voice of America and Radio Free Asia were forced to stop broadcasting for alleged breach of regulations. Genuine competition is essential to democracy and to the legitimacy of the 2018 national elections, said spokesperson Nauert. History proves that suppressing legitimate political activity leads to more long-term instability rather than less. We urge government officials to consider the serious implications of their recent actions, and we renew our call that the leader of the CNRP, Kem Sokha, be released from prison.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.